Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor-in-chief of the New Books Network, and the following interview is being republished with permission from the excellent podcast Psychologists Off the Clock. That's Psychologists Off the Clock at offtheclockpsych.com. I hope you enjoy the interview.
I think should make decisions about our lives based not on how can I pass on as many genes as I want to, but what's going to make me happy and what's going to make people in my life happy.
That was Dr. Steve Stewart Williams on Psychologists Off the Clock.
Curious what psychologists chat about over coffee?
We are three clinical psychologists who love to discuss the best ideas from psychology.
I'm Dr. Diana Hill, practicing in Seaside, Santa Barbara, California.
I'm Dr. Debbie Sorensen, practicing in Mile High, Denver, Colorado.
And from coast to coast, I'm Dr. Yael Schoenbrunn, a Boston-based clinical psychologist and assistant professor at Brown University.
In this podcast, we explore the psychological principles that we use in our clinical work.
And we bring you ideas from psychology that can help you flourish in your work, parenting, relationships, and health.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
We've been on a bit of an evolutionary science trend recently, which I have loved. So in this episode, I spoke with an evolutionary psychologist, Steve Stewart Williams, who recently came out with a really cool book called The Ape That Understood the Universe, How the Mind and Culture Evolve. And this book takes a really novel approach. It encourages the reader to take a look at humankind from the alien perspective.
I love that idea of the alien perspective on humans. It really gives us a chance to look at ourselves as a species, which can really change the way we're thinking about ourselves. I was a double major in psychology and anthropology in college, and I took a class called The Human Animal. And I think about that class a lot because I think we don't think of ourselves as a species or in this sort of global perspective very often. We're so caught up in our day-to-day that we forget sometimes to shift into this bigger, I don't know, perspective shift and looking at things from this way.
I also really like the alien perspective exercise because it reminds me of actually an ACT in the self as context component of ACT, which is where we encourage, you know, our clients to shift perspectives in order to get more information or different information, a different frame, as what Matthew Blett and RFT would say, a different frame on what we're looking at. And so it's really helpful to look at ourselves as a species from this different perspective.
Absolutely. And I think it's so useful. But what I think is really interesting, and this came up early on in my conversation with Dr. Stewart Williams, is that looking at ourselves in this way can sometimes be a little bit of a minefield. So we're going through a really important period of time, politically and otherwise, where exploration of things like gender differences and romantic behaviors is really under scrutiny. And we're wondering whether behavior should be tolerable because it's natural, or if it should be intolerable because, you know, it's hurtful to somebody else, even if it is natural. And so I think that those are really important things that come up when you're talking about evolutionary science.
Yeah. And what I really like as you were talking to Dr. Stewart Williams in this interview, Yael, is that he makes it really clear that just because a behavior happens to be, you know, quote, natural or based in evolution doesn't mean that it's moral or helpful or acceptable. And this is a really important idea too, when we think about in our own lives, moving toward our values, even when it might go against some sort of urge or drive or thought or emotion that we're having, we can still sometimes do better.
Yeah, it makes me think about actually in a couple of weeks, we're going to have Stefan Guyanet on, who talks all about our eating behavior. And it really relates to our relationship with, you know, eating and also exercise, that sometimes our urge, our instinct goes against our values around how we want to take care of ourselves. So this is a helpful way to view some of the behaviors that we're getting kind of entangled with.
Yeah. And another quick personal example that always comes up for me is about parenthood. I mean, we're sort of wired to respond to our kids, right? If they're sad, it sort of triggers an urge in us to take care of them. And I think in this way, it's not necessarily even an immoral behavior, but it's sometimes not a very useful behavior if we're valuing things like building resilience in our kids or building independence. And so I think for that reason, it can be really useful, even if it doesn't feel so natural, to kind of take a step back from our urges and really be curious about them. You know, is it a useful urge? Is it something that's consistent with our values, or is it not? So Dr. Stuart Williams provides a really nice overview of how we can learn more about evolutionary psychology in ways that help us to become more informed and make more useful decisions for our own lives. So let's take a listen. In this episode, I have the privilege of speaking with Dr. Steve Stuart Williams, professor of psychology at Nottingham University, Malaysia campus, and the author of the just-released book, The Ape That Understood the Universe, How the Mind and Culture Evolve. And I'll quickly mention that I'm speaking to him from Boston while he's in Malaysia, so if there's any audio issues, you'll understand why. We are going to discuss Dr. Stuart Williams' mind-bending book, which offers readers an opportunity to step away from their held understanding of human nature by turning it upside down and inside out. Dr. Stuart Williams' work explores how evolutionary biology and psychology can help us to better understand the human mind and human behavior and our culture. His work focuses on altruism, sex differences, and the philosophical implications of evolutionary theory. He draws on animal research, cross-cultural research, and laboratory research to help us learn about how the mind and culture evolve. Steve, welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
Your book sets the reader up to take on the alien perspective in exploring the human species, which is a pretty interesting approach. And it's an eye-opening opportunity to take on an outside view of ourselves. So I love so many of the lines in your book, and I love the premise of the book, but one of my favorite lines underscores how confusing we might be for an alien. You write, "A lot of what we do makes about as much adaptive sense as a hedgehog rolling into a ball in the face of oncoming traffic." So while we like to think evolution helps us to be adaptive and intelligent about behaviors, apparently we're not quite right.
Sure. Okay, so that line refers to a phenomenon called evolutionary mismatch. And the basic idea here is, so the hedgehog crossing the road, right? So imagine it's late at night and it's a hedgehog wandering around the forest happily. Suddenly it comes to this strange area of forest, which is actually a road. So as it wants to walk across the road, starts walking across. Suddenly, though, there are two lights shining down on the hedgehog. It's a car in the distance heading toward the hedgehog. What the hedgehog probably should do in that circumstance is run for it. Run, try to get off the road as quickly as it possibly can before it gets turned into a pancake. Unfortunately, though, the hedgehog isn't going to do that. What it's probably going to do is it's going to get a shock, and it's going to roll up into a big spiky ball and just stay right there. Now, rolling up into a spiky ball is quite useful in its natural setting. Like if a predator comes along, starts sniffing around, maybe seeing this hedgehog is going to make a good meal. If it rolls up into a spiky ball, that might dissuade the predator. But when it's face to face with a car, that's really not going to work. So that's not adaptive behavior. And the question is, well, does that mean that does that like falsify an evolutionary account of hedgehog behavior? The answer is that it doesn't, and the reason is that the road isn't the natural environment in which the hedgehog evolved. You know, roads are very, very new. They're evolutionarily novel situations for a hedgehog. It hasn't evolved any kind of adaptive response to that particular threat. The moral of that story for us is that in a lot of ways, we're in the same boat as the hedgehog. So in a lot of ways, the environment that we currently live in is very different than the one in which our species spent most of its evolutionary history. Good example, maybe the best known example, is that human beings, like a lot of primates, we have a sweet tooth. Okay, we really love sweet food. We like to eat as much of it as we can. And in our natural setting, like throughout the vast majority of our evolutionary history, that was fine. That motivated us to eat good calorie-rich sources of food whenever we had the opportunity. In our modern environment, though, that's not a recipe for success. We can just eat too much really, really bad food. We can eat too much chocolate and cheesecakes and desserts and blah, blah, blah. We can eat pretty much an unlimited amount to the detriment of our health. And that's because we're just in a very different environment, a very different food environment than the one in which we evolved.
Right. So in that way, all of these adaptive traits that we've sort of landed on, to some extent, many of them don't work in our modern environment. So that's kind of where the hedgehog example comes in. I mean, those spikes are so useful, but not in front of a car that's coming right at them. And I think that those ideas are so helpful in the space of clinical psychology, because I think that if we can understand some of our natural tendencies, then and understand the ways in which they may or may not be adaptive, we can sort of make better choices. And that was something you and I had discussed a little bit as we were making plans to do this episode, the ways in which evolutionary psychology can actually be helpful for people in their everyday lives. So And I think, and we'll talk a bit about this, but you know, we have this idea that evolutionary science is sort of very academic, but I think that more and more it's being brought into the clinical psychology space. But I think that you make a note of this. It's another one of my favorite lines. This is a very funny book. I will tell the listeners. It's very amusing. But you write that many psychologists have an empty space in their brains where their knowledge of evolution should be. So I'm curious, you know, in what ways do you think that knowing more about evolution and our natural instincts is something useful for people in their everyday lives? How can we take advantage of that information and that knowledge?
Sure. Can I first say, I think I was a little bit apprehensive about that line. I thought, I really hope that's taken in the spirit that it's intended.
I thought it was very playful and fun.
Good. Well, I'm glad. But yeah, but the basic idea is, like you say, I think that taking an evolutionary approach to ourselves and to human nature, I think that can inform our understanding of psychology, for a start. I think that also understanding animal behavior. And if just people knew more about the behavior of other animals, I think that as well would just help us to understand ourselves, ways in which we are more like other animals than we might have guessed, ways as well that we're different. In terms of practical implications of that knowledge, I guess just springboarding from the hedgehog and the sweet tooth example, I guess a kind of one very general lesson there would be that, especially in our modern environment, we can't just sort of automatically trust our emotions and our desires are going to lead us into adaptive behavior in any sense of that term, because we're in such a different environment from the one in which we evolved. You know, I think some people think it's a good idea to just follow your feelings and follow your instincts. Perhaps in a more natural environment, that might be a good idea, lead us into more adaptive behaviors. I think in the modern world, often it's not going to do that, and we should maybe check ourselves and think about it.
There's this very typical example from clinical psychology that we're really wired to sort of lean towards negative interpretations of neutral stimuli. So that sort of comes from, you know, we could think about it from our caveman days. It's safer for us to assume that there's a saber-toothed tiger coming at us than to miss any cues that there might be a saber-toothed tiger coming at us. And so for that reason, we might assume that a negative event is on the horizon when it isn't. And at one period of time in our sort of evolutionary history, that might have served us well. But in our current modern environment, where, you know, for the most part, there's very few, relatively speaking, dangers that are sort of going to come at us from our natural environment. And, you know, we're well protected. We have shelter, you know, from the elements, and we're not in as much danger, and yet we feel this sense of, you know, there could be danger lurking around every corner. And I think what you're saying is that it can be helpful to recognize that sometimes our emotions are less informative than they are sort of a bit of an evolutionary mismatch for our modern environment.
Yeah, indeed. So I think if you understand that principle you're talking about, where we have this negativity bias, just understanding that potentially could let us take a step back from those emotions and just kind of defuse them a bit. Just understanding, you know, why do I feel so nervous about this? Well, there is a quite strong evolutionary rationale for why I might be over worrying about this. And just, I think, potentially just understanding that could scale back the strength of that negative response and the strength of that worry, potentially. There's a converse as well, though, which I think is perhaps that in other ways, we don't worry enough about certain things, maybe not as individuals, but as a society, there are perhaps evolutionarily novel threats.
Oh, like what? Give us some examples.
Well, global warming would be one example, I think. It's completely evolutionarily unprecedented. It's not the sort of thing that we've evolved to worry about. So I think, and it's something that I think that we should worry about, as a society at least, because it doesn't come so naturally to us, as perhaps a taste. It's like an acquired taste. We need to learn to worry an appropriate amount about things like that.
Right.
And I guess also things like Big Macs, eating too many Big Macs, eating too much junk food, things like that.
Yeah, that sweet tooth, that desire for fatty foods.
Indeed. We need to make sure that we are worried enough about that. Yeah. You know, not to the point of an anxiety disorder, but just that these are bad for you if you eat them too much.
Yeah, this idea is really built into one of the very popular and evidence-based approaches to doing therapy called acceptance and commitment therapy. And in this kind of therapy, what clinical psychologists do is they help their patients, their clients, to identify both the emotions but also the values, and then better clarity on their present circumstances. And so I think from an evolutionary point of view, it's kind of useful to take in the information, but then take a step back and use that as one piece of information instead of emotions being the entire driver of all behavioral decisions.
Yeah, I agree. And I think emotions, at least the basic emotions, very plausibly have an evolutionary origin. And what that means is that their function is not to make you happy. It's not to make the world a better place. The function of those emotions ultimately is just to pass on the genes that gave rise to those emotions in the first place that caused their development. Unless, you know, most people, I don't think that their main value in life is to pass on their genes. That, I think, would be a very strange value to hold. I think people value other things. And so I think it's good for them to know that these basic emotions and motivations, that kind of thing, that then they don't necessarily align with your values. They instead are just about passing on the genes giving rise to them. If that's not your value as an individual that you want to focus on in your life, then you should do some second guessing of your emotions and motivations.
Right. Jonathan Haidt, who's a moral psychologist, has this great line where he sort of says, you know, there's kind of two questions that we can ask. What is the point of life and what's the point within life? And I think that you're sort of pointing to that. And what you're sort of pointing to, and you talk about in great detail in your book, is that the purpose of life is really to pass on genes. And so I wonder if you could talk us through, I mean, it's a very complex idea, but I wonder if you could talk us through some of the generalities of the gene machine idea. So for those of you who don't remember evolutionary science from high school or college, Steve's book offers a great in-depth exploration of the workings of natural selection. So I wonder if you could talk us through some of that.
Yeah, okay. So it is quite a complex idea, but I think probably the simplest way I can think of to articulate gene machine idea is just simply that that organisms are designed in quote marks, designed by natural selection to pass on their genes. And the rationale for that is pretty simple, really. It's that if you imagine any gene, if that gene has effects on the organism that mean that organism won't pass on its genes, or that mean that organism will pass on its genes at a slower rate than its next-door neighbor, that gene is going to eventually just evaporate from the gene pool, disappear from the gene pool. And it's just going to leave genes that do have effects that mean that the organism with those genes will pass those genes on. Those are the genes that natural selection will retain. And the net effect of selection taking retaining genes that cause the organism in which they're found to pass on those genes is that organisms evolve into gene machines. They evolve basically into entities that look like their sole purpose in life is to propagate their genetic material, to pass on their genes in various different ways, mainly by having offspring. So that's the gene machine idea.
Yeah, and I think that understanding sort of the importance of reproducing oneself and having offspring really sets you up to, as an evolutionary scientist, to really be interested in the relationship behavior on the level of sex, courtship, partnership, and parenting. And that's those are some of the areas that you dive into. And they're somewhat controversial. So I do want to have you talk to us a little bit about what we know about the evolution of sex, courtship, partnership, and parenting. But before we do, I was hoping that we could start off by talking a bit about why evolution science can be so controversial. Why, for example, is there so much controversy about sex differences? And this is kind of an interesting time for your book to be coming out because there's the backdrop of the Me Too and the Time's Up movement. So understandably, thinking about sex differences and sort of highlighting the biological differences and the rationale behind them and sort of it can be something of a minefield.
Yep, indeed, that's very true. So why is it so controversial? I vacillate in my thoughts about that. So sometimes I think I don't really understand why it would be so controversial and why it would be quite so upsetting to people, the idea that in a certain number of traits there are generally quite modest average differences between the sexes. You know, that on average the sexes are not identical. A lot of the traits where we have the differences are relatively neutral. They're not sort of things that, to my mind, would necessarily be too upsetting that there are average differences between the sexes. Like I say, the differences are often quite modest. The differences between the means are quite modest. And within each sex, you get a lot of variation. And there's overlap between the variation for men versus women. A lot of the traits, I think, that are discussed in the book, if either sex comes off worse, it's often men rather than women. So, for instance, on average, men are more physically aggressive than women. That's a cross-culturally consistent kind of finding. And I think that puts men rather than women in a bad light, right? Like, unless one thinks that aggression is a desirable trait and violence is a desirable trait, then that's sort of saying that more men than women have this negative trait. So that's one reaction that I have, is that I don't fully understand why it's quite so controversial.
Do you think that one of the things that can be troubling is if people get this sense, and you sort of mentioned this before, that because if we say, you know, there's a biological difference and there is something inherently different about men's level of aggression compared to women's level of aggression, that in some sense it almost gives permission for aggressive behavior. And so that maybe is a little bit of a danger zone to say, oh, well, it's natural and therefore okay. And I think you talk a lot about that in your book, that that's actually not what evolutionary science tries to suggest. And in fact, quite the opposite. You know, just because it's natural does not mean it's okay or good or permissible.
Absolutely. Yeah. So the mistake of assuming that to say something is evolved means that it's necessarily good or morally permissible. That's often called the naturalistic fallacy. It's quite a common reaction is to think that just because something is adaptive, it must be good or it must be. To say something's adaptive in the evolutionary sense means that it must be adaptive in the everyday sense. In other words, adaptive in terms of creating a good life. It really doesn't imply that at all. Like you say, so if men on average are more violent than women, which they seem to be, an evolutionary perspective may explain that, but there's no reason at all to think that explaining it is justifying it. I think that you need to draw quite a big distinction between explanation and our moral values, and we really shouldn't derive our moral values from our understanding of our evolutionary history and some of the sort of innate contributions. I think my favorite example, I think, is there's aggression on the one hand. So to say that aggression is natural is not to say it's good. In fact, aggression is natural but bad. On the other hand, you have things like medicine, Universal Declaration of Human Rights, all these kind of things are human-made, but are good. Despite not being adaptations, they're good things, morally good things. So I agree with you. I think that is one of the reasons that people don't like it, is they think it's justifying it, sometimes they think we're stuck with it, as I think is another issue. And it's not nice to think that we might be stuck with undesirable kind of traits. They're not necessarily right about that either. I think in some cases we can move beyond evolved traits. You know, like natural selection might give us a push in a certain direction, but like our genes are only one influence among many shaping us. So there are social factors that come in as well, and those social factors can counteract evolved tendencies. We know they can, right? If you look at how rates of aggression have come down over the ages, slowly but surely, over the decades, centuries, millennia, levels of violence have come down, despite the fact that aggression and violence seem to be natural propensities within human nature. There's also actually another reason that people are quite wary of discussion of sex differences. I think it's because we have quite a long history of, you know, in the 1800s and early 1900s in particular. So we've got a long history of society in general and scientists specifically making very, very sexist claims, very, very poorly backed, in fact, not empirically backed, claims about the sexes that are very sexist. I've got a quote in my book, actually, from a scientist from the 1800s. His name was Gustave Le Bon, and he said something along the lines of that. He said, okay, sure. There are some distinguished women, sure, but they're about as rare as like a two-headed gorilla or any other monstrosity. And he was a scientist. Exactly. So terrible things like that have been said in the past. And people have used these kind of things to justify keeping women out of the public sphere, keeping them in the kitchen, that kind of thing. I think that the wariness about the discussion of sex differences traces in large part back to that. I think that's quite an understandable reaction why people would be a little bit dubious about treading in that territory again. So just to be clear, I think the kind of sex differences that I discuss in the book are nothing like that. I don't think there's any merit at all to the claim that distinguished women are equivalent to two-headed gorillas. And like I said before, if anything, a lot of them put men rather than women in a not-so-good light. So some of the differences that I discuss. So one of them, besides the aggression one, another one that seems to be kind of controversial, so walking into another landmine here.
Go for it.
is that that on average, it seems to be the case that men are more interested in casual sex and sexual variety than women. There's an average difference there. It is not a trivial difference. It's certainly not... Like it's not a dichotomous difference such that all men are interested in casual sex and only casual sex. No women are interested. It's not a difference like that. But it has an effect size, typical estimate, maybe like 0.8. So
that's a pretty significant effect size, yeah.
It is indeed, yeah. So basically means that there's nearly a standard deviation's difference between the mean for men in terms of interest in casual sex and the mean for women. And I think quite a sort of an intuitive way to put it might be to say that if you were to take completely random one man, one woman, the man would be more interested in casual sex than the woman around 2/3 of the time, maybe 70% of the time. So not always, certainly not always. There is overlap. But
well, I recall from your book, you described a really interesting study, and you can correct me if I get this wrong, but the study was something like the research assistants approaching men and women in a public space and basically hitting on them and in some cases, you know, inviting them to go back to their house to have casual sex. And what they found was that basically no women said yes to the invitation, at least for casual sex, whereas a good portion of the men did say yes. Am I remembering that right?
Yeah. So you're exactly right. That is what they found. They actually found that 75% of men said yes to the invitation. The exact wording was, "Would you go to bed with me?" I think, and 75% of men said yes to that. Of the remaining 25%, some of them, most of them were sort of quite apologetic. Some of them said, "Well, thank you, but I'm meeting my fiance." Some of them even asked for a rain check, like I'm meeting my fiance, but maybe some other time. So 75% of men, as opposed to 0%, like you say, 0% of women in that study. It's been replicated various times. The exact numbers vary, of course.
How do you know that that's not simply caused by you know, social engineering and sort of the expectations that we place on men and women. And I'm sort of asking this question with a little bit of background, having read your book, but I wonder if you can explain sort of how you rule out culture as causing all of these kinds of differences, at least in the realm of casual sex.
So yes, I wouldn't rule out that culture does play a role here. I think that it's just one of several factors. In the Would You Go to Bed With Me study in particular, I think cultural norms would come into it. I think also that it's a lot riskier for a woman to go off with some random guy she doesn't know than it is for a guy to go off with some random woman that he doesn't know. So that's going to, I think that's why it's such a big difference, even though other ways of measuring interest in casual sex, the difference isn't so big. But in terms of how do we know that it's not just culture, I think there are several lines of evidence that suggest that it's not just culture. One is that even when the culture pushes against this kind of tendency, the tendency seems to stubbornly remain. So we have a long history, Western societies, for instance, of trying to dampen men's stronger inclination for sexual variety and the like, monogamy norms, threats of hellfire and damnation for sleeping with more than one person within the Christian moral system, for instance, social pressure to not to engage in that. Despite all that, nonetheless, the sex difference does remain. Hence, that in a lot of cases, the sex difference appears despite culture. Another line of evidence is that there's a correlation within each sex, a correlation between testosterone levels, like prenatal testosterone levels, and interest in casual sex. And of course, and that's within sex, but of course, there's an average difference in prenatal testosterone between the sexes. And that's prenatally, right? So that suggests that probably socialization can't account for that aspect of it. If you find it in all different cultures, I think that as far as we know, wherever we have good data, we seem to find the same sex difference. It's pretty consistent. The sizes vary somewhat, but it's always, comparable in terms of its magnitude, which again is easier to explain in evolutionary terms than in purely sociocultural terms. And then one last bit of evidence is that there's some evidence that in societies that are more, sort of patriarchal and less gender equal, you actually find that the sex difference in interest in casual sex tends to be smaller rather than larger, which is kind of the opposite of what you'd expect based on a social role interpretation and the idea that it just comes out of social roles, and therefore in societies with bigger social roles, you'd anticipate that that difference would be larger rather than smaller. Sort of counterintuitively, it's the other way around.
Wait, so societies that have more emphasis on having men in a patriarchal role, the men have less interest in casual sex?
Well, the sex difference is smaller.
Yeah. The sex difference is smaller.
Yeah, exactly. And then in societies where people have more freedom, the social roles are not as strongly prescribed, and people have more scope to do what they want. The sex difference seems to grow somewhat, surprisingly enough. And yeah, it's not what you'd expect based on a social role interpretation.
Yeah. It's also interesting in light of the fact that marital researchers have discovered that marriage actually provides more protective benefits for men than for women. So it always kind of strikes me, in the conversation where, men might talk about, greater interest in pursuing non-monogamy, that finding bears out pretty consistently in the marital literature, that there's benefits for both men and women in marriage, both for health, both in physical health and psychological health, but that the benefits tend to be larger for men.
For men, yeah, I've read that. Interesting, right? Really interesting.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think that's a really good example of how to say something is adaptive in the evolutionary sense is not necessarily to say that it's adaptive in the everyday sense or the sense that we care about, right? So it may be more adaptive for men to have sex with as many women as they can, have as many kids as they can, adaptive in the evolutionary sense. But who cares about that, right? Like a lot of men would probably be, not all, but a lot might be happier in a long-term relationship. They may have fewer offspring in that context, but who cares about that, right? We should make decisions about our lives based not on how can I pass on as many genes as I want to, but what's going to make me happy and what's going to make people in my life happy.
Right, right. And as a couples therapist, I think this comes up all the time in the therapy room, right? When you have a couple that comes in, and I've certainly seen that exact example where one of the partners might be interested in having an open relationship and the others, it's kind of a non-starter. And for them, that would mean an end to the relationship. And so, you know, the individual with an interest in opening up the relationship has in several circumstances that I can think of, decided to just tolerate, you know, not fulfilling that drive in order to hold on to that monogamous relationship with that one partner that they've built a life with. And for them, you know, I think that there's some discomfort and some a sense of loss in not being able to pursue what their hormones or their emotions or even what their internal narrative might long for. But there's also a sense of real satisfaction in being able to decide, make good decisions, make not necessarily good decisions, but decisions that are value consistent in terms of prioritizing their you know, primary partner and their relationship with their primary partner.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. And I guess we can't have it all, right? I think we do have conflicting desires. And so most people, you know, not just men, but most people probably have some desire for sexual variety and also a desire for a long-term relationship. And you know, sometimes you have to make a decision about which of those options you're going to pursue. Either way, you may potentially miss out on something, but gain something else. And,
I actually, it's I think what you're saying really lines up with a quote that I wrote down from your book, just because I really liked it. And that I'm going to read you a quote from your book, which is, whatever we do as humans, we're left with unfulfilled desires. Human beings are chronically conflicted animals. And that's because that's what selection made us. And so I think you're pointing to something that's so fundamental to being human, which is that we want lots of things, and often the things that we want are in different directions. But there's something about the way that natural selection has contributed to who we are and how we operate that's just a part of our existence. And I think expecting it to be otherwise is something that doesn't serve us well. But recognizing that truth, that we are sort of inherently conflicted creatures, I think there's something really lovely about that, because you don't have to fight with it so much. You can sort of say, oh, well, that's just a part of who I am and who we all are.
Yeah, that's how I feel about it as well. Right before that quote, I actually, I think it says something along the lines of, this is the tragedy of the human condition, something like that. I think that's too strong, really. It's not, you know, it's more irritating than tragic. And I just think, tragic is too strong. I think it is something that we can take in our stride. And I do agree with you that it is better to confront it rather than deny it. I think for me, at least, that's the way to get past these kind of things, is to confront the ways in which the world is maybe not the way that we would choose it to be, rather than be in denial about that.
Yeah. So one other area that I think sort of encapsulates this idea of having many and sometimes conflicting desires is the area of parental investment. So I had been telling you that one of the areas that I write a lot about, and I'm actually working on a book on this topic, is the idea of work-family conflict and work-family balance. And I think in your book, you talk a lot about this idea of parental investment, sort of the difference between the sexes in parental investment and sort of how evolution has differentiated between men and women on that front. And I think this is a really interesting area as it applies to how the work-family conflict plays out in our modern society, right? Because when we evolved, we didn't have offices to go to, and we had more specialized roles as in a gendered way, sort of from, you know, very far back in human history. But in this modern society that we live in, we have on the one hand, more opportunities and more choices to make. And on the other hand, we do desire to, for example, I think men and women, and perhaps women more, you argue women more, might want to invest at a greater level in raising children than men do, except you do see it on both sides, right? There's an interest in raising children and investing in that role and in that relationship. And there's an interest in sort of going into the workforce and making our mark on the in the public sphere. So I think that I'm sort of curious what you think about how evolution science and psychology informs that conversation about how work-family conflict plays out.
Yep, sure. So you're leading me into another landmine area.
So that's fine.
Tread lightly. So I think there's a good case to be made that both sexes in our species are parental. I guess that's where I want to start. Is to say that so in most mammals, the females are parental and the males are not. But basically, females are solo mums. They do all the parental care. And dads, they're all deadbeat dads. Now, that's not the case in our species. Okay? We're a very atypical mammal in that that both sexes very often invest quite heavily in the young, both in terms of direct and indirect investment. So this would be the starting place. So I'm certainly not claiming that women are parental and men are not. There do, however, seem to be average differences between the sexes. Once again, these differences are not absolute in men. Plenty of men who are more parental than the average woman, etc. But nonetheless, there do seem to be average differences. In terms of work-life balance, so I guess just knowing that, let's imagine, so our alien scientist comes along, figures that out about us, and just assume for the moment that this is actually the case, that there are these average differences, and that they're not 100% learned, that there is also an innate contribution to the average differences. So the alien knew that. I think the alien would then not be hugely surprised to then discover that more women than men have this work-life balance issue, and that it's a bigger deal to more women than men. And again, it's an issue for both, right? I've seen research showing that for both sexes, balancing work and family life and home life is an issue, right? I think, in fact, I recently saw something, I can't remember if it was a Pew study or something like that, showing the gap recently, such that more men were, you know, they were getting closer to women in terms of this being an issue. I think what I'd say, though, is that I would be surprised if this average difference in parental inclinations isn't one of the causes that feeds into the work-life balance issue. And I'd be surprised if it wasn't one of the things that means it's more common among women than men to have that kind of issue.
Yeah. And I think too, I mean, one of the other, this is a little bit tangential, but I just thought this was really interesting that one of the solutions that we as a society often come to in with regard to the work-family balance issue is this idea of if only we could delegate out more childcare, right, that would help women and men sort of worry less about their parenting role and be able to participate more fully in the workforce. And you gave this really interesting example that I personally relate to of kibbutzim, these communes that were really common in Israel at the founding of Israel in the 1940s. And my father actually grew up on one of these, and he grew up in a children's house, which was really common in that era. And the way that this kibbutz system worked is that they would really specialize the roles. So parents had their roles on the kibbutz, and they participated in them fully. And then some of the workers participated by way of doing childcare. And so the kids would be raised in these houses away from their parents so that their parents could do their work and that the kids were very well taken care of. But ultimately, that system didn't work because parents really wanted to take care of their own children. There was something very biological and sort of just an innate drive to want to be the one participating in a lot of the childcare. And I think that that's sort of an important point. And I don't know sort of based on your research, how much that is more relevant to women than for men. But my sense is that that's true for both women and men a lot of the time, that there is this sort of innate desire to participate in the caregiving for our own offspring, and that there isn't sort of a simple solution of, oh, well, we just need more childcare that we can delegate that out to somebody else. But it's actually something that we're innately driven to do. We desire to be a part of that process.
I agree. I completely agree that it's not as women. It's both sexes have that kind of drive. You want to be part of your kid's life and want to spend time with your kid and not just delegate it out to other people. So I do think that it definitely applies to both sexes. Within the kibbutz study that I cited, found that the parents in general were not happy with that situation, like you described, but that it was often the women in particular who were really instrumental in changing things. And often they were fighting against the men, in fact. So like a lot of the men were sort of holding out. They were saying, no, that's a bourgeois kind of tendency, and it's the wrong way to do it, and we need to just carry on with the current arrangement. But the women in particular were really fighting, which is interesting, right? Sort of suggests, at least in that case, that rather than being sort of forced into that role by the men, they had to rebel against those men in order to have a greater connection with their kids. Men as well, you know, were rebelling against those particular men who thought, no, we've got to carry on this way so that they could do the same thing. But it did seem to be stronger in women. And you know, there are various other lines of evidence that do suggest that parental inclinations may be stronger on average in women than in men. You know, it comes out in play behavior very early on. Girls are more likely to engage in play mothering than boys are. That mirrors the pattern that you find in other closely related animals, chimpanzees, for instance. Little girl chimps will sometimes like pick up a log and kind of cradle it and put it in their nest and kind of look after it, treat it in effect like a little chimpanzee doll. Boys do that. Chimpanzee boys occasionally would do that, but it's just less common. So you know, it seems to be that we're mirroring a trend that is found in other species as well. There are prenatal hormonal correlates as well that suggest that it's not 100% a cultural difference.
I was just going to invite you into one final minefield of these sex differences, and that is the and you go into some detail about this in the book, but the difference between men and women on the priority placed on the importance of status versus the status and wealth versus the importance of looking good. And this is sort of like an interesting and I think also controversial area that we think about this as really being culturally influenced and really culturally determined, the way that we sort of stereotype, oh, women are more interested in men who have high status and greater wealth, and men are more interested in young, attractive, fertile-looking women. But you argue in the book that there is something that really comes from evolution, and that is pretty innate to the two sexes, which determines that. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that difference.
Yeah, sure. So this is so average sex differences in terms of mate preferences. And I think the way I put it, so I think a lot of people, and in fact, actually, sometimes evolutionary psychologists will put it this way. They'll say, or at least give the impression, so men are primarily interested in physical attractiveness in a mate, whereas women are interested in other stuff. They're interested in status and wealth and that kind of thing. Now, I actually think that some of the controversy is because that isn't really the right way to describe it. I think that isn't an accurate description of the findings. I would say, especially with physical attractiveness, that both sexes consider it pretty important to have an attractive mate. You know, not just men. It's both sexes are interested in having an attractive mate. It's not the most important priority for either sex on average, but it's pretty important for both sexes. So the difference is really one of degree, and that's that the average is greater for men than for women. There's variation in both sexes, but it's like the whole distribution for men has been just shifted up, like the volume has been turned up for the whole distribution for men relative to women, such that the average is bigger. Now, that there are various reasons to think that does have there's an innate contribution to that, that it does have an evolutionary origin. One is the fact that it seems to be cross-culturally universal, that you get this particular difference. That's one line of evidence. There are various others as well. The theory behind it relates to fertility, and it relates to the fact that so fertility is related to age for both sexes, but the relationship is stronger for women than men. So fertility is more age dependent for women than men because of menopause. So for that reason, the idea is that men evolved to focus more, somewhat more, on cues to youthfulness than women did. Now, I think probably for both sexes, youthfulness looks better than, people prefer youthfulness in a mate. It just seems to be somewhat more of a priority for men than women. The argument being that that's primarily because of menopause. Other species like chimps that don't have menopause, the females don't undergo menopause, so males don't have the preference for youthful females, which sort of fits quite nicely with the theory that it is about the age fertility connection. So that's that landmine. The other one is the wealth and status one. And again, I guess I preface that by saying that it's not the be-all and end-all for most women. You know, some, no doubt, but it's one thing among many that people want along with – that women want along with physical attractiveness and intelligence and, good character, emotional balance. A lot of those things, in fact, are actually usually more important to women than things like status and wealth. But again, the finding seems to be that across cultures – status and wealth are more important on average to women than is the case for men.
Yeah, and we won't have time to go into it, but one of the areas that you talk about in your book is altruism and sort of how this idea of altruistic behavior has evolved. And I loved the point that altruism is something that we find attractive in mates too, and it's something that really drives interest in potential mates. And so it really isn't just those few either youth or status and wealth, but there's a whole lot of things that we desire, hence our inner conflict as human creatures.
Indeed. And the altruism one, that's good news, right?
It's good news.
So a lot of the stuff coming out of evolutionary science is a bit of a bummer. some of it is bad news, but that's one example where it's good news. And in fact, I think all the altruism stuff, I think, is probably the most optimistic section of the book.
Yeah.
So if you're feeling bummed out.
read that section if you want to undo the bummed out. No, I think that it is a really lovely concept that you go into in great detail, and I love the idea that altruism is something that evolved along with a whole lot of other tendencies that we have, and it's a part of what makes us a cooperative species who surprisingly helps each other out a lot. We have this sometimes very negative view of human culture and the way that we interact with one another, but if we take a step back and take that alien view, we can really see a lot of lovely ways that we collaborate and cooperate and support one another and continue to grow and evolve in really interesting and delightful ways.
Yeah, that's right. And we need to find cultural ways to amp up the altruistic side of ourselves and diminish the less pleasant stuff.
Absolutely. And I think that that's kind of among the many take-home messages from your book and hopefully from this interview, that knowing more about evolution and about how our minds and behaviors have evolved can help us to disentangle our natural instincts to pass along our genes from the choices that would help us to build happier and more fulfilling lives and maybe happier and more collaborative and cooperative societies. We're not blank slates. We have evolved to have many natural proclivities that help our genes to pass along. But we've also evolved to have a tremendous amount of flexibility and an ability to choose towards and away from various behaviors and ideas. I don't know if there's other main take-home messages that you want to make sure to emphasize here, but...
No, I like that. I think it's a very good summary.
We'll link to your wonderful book so that listeners can find out more about ourselves as apes that understand the universe. And again, it's a really fun and funny and enlightening read, so I highly recommend it. And please share this episode with folks who you think might enjoy being empowered by knowledge of evolutionary psychology.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to Psychologists Off the Clock.
You can find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter.
This podcast is for informational and entertainment purposes only and is not meant to be a substitute for mental health treatment. If you are having a mental health emergency, please dial 911. If you're looking for mental health treatment, please visit the resources on our webpage.
Our website is www.offtheclockpsych.com. That's www.offtheclockpsych.com.